So first of all, we have Armin Yanizian, our first speaker. And I will need to read notes. It would have been impossible for me to learn her biography by heart. She holds an industrial relations degree, and her aim is to assist various communities, and she works at Toronto University. She has been for 10 years a program manager. She was a planning director for the Toronto Council. In 1998, she published a report, which is called The Growing Gap. And it deals with this lack of equity in the wages of Canadian workers. She published a number of articles. She's written and spoken about equity in Canada. And she also was awarded the award from the Atkinson Institute. So congratulations. She also worked with the Alternative Political Canadian Center that looks into the future of the medical system in Canada. She also sits on the committee of JAM, on the Canadian Action Committee, and the Status of Women's Committee. And she has taken part in various federal government groups. She's also been a volunteer when it came to committees on social reform. She's also a member of the Center for Public Interest Defense, amongst other things. So here she is, Armin. Thank you, Annick, and thanks to all of you, brothers and sisters, for inviting me here. So I'm going to continue in English.
Mostly women, everybody wants to talk, and I want to talk too. So I'm going to talk as quickly as I can. I can only do that in English. My job, as I understand it, is to set the frame, basically describe the contours of the canvas on which you are going to paint the picture of the coming years. And context is indeed everything. So it's not just the economic context I'm going to talk to you about, but context, 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 economic context, the context of trade unionism at this moment, and the context of feminism at this moment. So let me start with the economic context. I don't know if you've noticed or not, but we're in a recession. And this is no ordinary recession. This is, in fact, the global rupture of a supply chain like we've never seen before. They wanted global free trade. They got it. Watch, as the newfies will say, watch what you wish for you may get it. This is a one-world phenomenon, and there is no escaping this one. And what it has shown is, in fact, we may or may not be in a Great Depression that is global, but we are in a period of the Great Repudiation, where for the last 30 years we've been told that markets are the solution and governments are the problem, and now nobody can say that with a straight face. So we've seen actually a reversal of how we conduct business as usual, where governments must act, they need to act, or this global slowdown will continue to bring down millions more households globally. And that's where we're starting to falter. On both sides of the border, not quite clear what our governments are going to do. If the governments act, this doesn't need to be very painful. If they don't act quickly, precisely, boldly, swiftly, then this can be a very protracted period of economic dislocation of the scale we haven't seen since the Depression. And may I just reinforce that that is utterly avoidable. What it has also revealed is the real interconnectedness of both the rich and the poor. If you remember, what brought this whole house of cards down were very poor households in the United States that had mortgages that probably shouldn't have had it. And what has happened is the greed of bankers looking for somebody that will borrow money on terms that will provide them with steady rates of return that are unaffordable for those who they are lending to, have shown this intersection between borrowers and lenders, between rich lenders and poor borrowers, and the absolute interconnection of international financial structures and the rich and poor locally and globally. If you think of it as a Jenga stack, what is at the bottom of the Jenga stack as we pull out little bits and pieces and wonder if the whole structure is going to fall apart, what is at the bottom of that is a household financial structure, which, by the way, is the root of the word economics, oikos, which is about household economics, family budgets. That household economics has been stretched and strained to the limit. So we're not just talking about a cyclical downturn, we're talking about a structural problem that has been creeping over the decades that now really faces a moment of truth. This isn't just about, as the finance minister would like us to think, just getting in and out of the recession as fast as we can and going back to business as usual, because business as usual in 2007 was not sustainable. And here's why. For 30 long years, the average wage in this country and in the United States has been stagnant. But shelter costs haven't. Shelter costs have been taking up a bigger and bigger bite of housing. Energy costs, till very recently, were soaring. The costs of education have doubled, tripled at the post-secondary level. And consequently, household debt has exploded. So we have a situation in which businesses are over-leveraged, banks are over-leveraged, households are over-leveraged. There is a big period of climbing down that is going to take place. Global deleveraging. This is a structural problem. If the issue is simply extending credit to people that shouldn't be borrowing in the first place, because if they lose their job, they can't make their credit card payments, then this is not a sustainable problem to simply throw money and cash at the banking system. That rapid growing gap between rich and poor, despite 10 years of blockbuster economic growth. You know, 1997 to 2007 was a period of sustained and strong economic growth, the likes of which we didn't see since the 1960s. But in the 60s, we had generalized wage growth. In that period that I'm talking about, 1997 to 2007, most of the wage gains went to the top. And so you had growing inequality even in good times. And that has led to spatial polarization because of housing costs, where if you don't have good incomes, you're living in low-rent neighborhoods. And what's the definition of a low-rent neighborhood? Poor schools, few community centers, lack of green space, lousy public transit systems. Basically, a place that you wouldn't want to live if you had a choice not to. And that's why they're low rent. And that means increased stress on the community services, the schools, the healthcare services that are located there. Folks, those are your jobs. You are at the eye of the storm when it comes to inequality. You are watching it on the front lines, rolling in through community centers, through public services. And that growing gap has led to an increase in demand for two-tier healthcare, a walking away of responsibilities from public provisions of good quality public education, and reduction in services at the community level, and also a running down of public assets, whether it's housing, social housing, or rinks and pools. You know, all the structure, the infrastructure that my parents' generation built, that us, with roughly $1 trillion more sloshing around in the economy every year than there was 25 years ago, $1 trillion more we're producing, we can't find the money to repair and sustain the infrastructure our parents built with a fraction of those resources. That is a generational slight to us, and we should rise to that challenge. In fact, there has been a huge risk shift between governments offloading their debt and their responsibilities and breaking apart risk pooling, and that risk has been transferred to the private sector and households, individual households, and the ones that are least able to afford it are facing the most risk. We are heading into a recession where households owe $1.41 on every dollar they earn on average. And you know, averages mean there's lots of people that have lots of savings. I want to compare that to what it was like in 1984. 1984 was the peak of the fallout from the biggest recession we had seen at that point since the Depression. At that peak, when unemployment was roughly 11%, the average household owed 70 cents on every dollar of income. So you can see in 2008, before the storm has even blown open, We are in a very precarious position for too many people. And as unemployment rises, you can expect to see more and more news littered with credit card defaults, personal bankruptcies, and mortgage foreclosures. A wave of economic dislocation as people sell things, scramble for whatever job they can have, try to move to cheaper places to live, and there aren't any. So we're looking at a very significant period of dislocation unless our governments act and act quickly. And I want to say to you that the first order of business for government is stability, not growth, which is a reversal of the primary purpose of government over the last 30 years. What governments were there to do since 1980 is stimulate economic growth. Now they need to stop the decline, and that's a very different type of intervention. Now I want you to listen to me. I'm saying stability, not growth. That means the same, not more. Yet what we want is more. What we want and what is long overdue is more. The status quo is not enough for women. It's not enough for people of color. The status quo does not serve the recent immigrants that are coming to this country. It does not help the Aboriginals that have been asking for decades to be treated with dignity and respect. It does not serve the millions of people that are turning to food banks right now. The status quo is not good enough, but the moment is about stability, not growth. And we need to take that moment and talk about poverty prevention as the way we are going to create stability. Now, governments are not compounding the misery like they did in the 1980s and 1990s by cutting back programs, not yet. But even when times were good, let me just remind you, we did not get what we were promised. Do you remember the Red Book promise of 1993 that when the economy grew by 3%, we would have a child care program? And we had the economy growing by much more than 3%, never saw that child care program. And we have lost ground on what we have so hard fought for example, pay equity and employment equity, things that we struggled for decades, won, and now have lost. And we have lost funding for the groups that advocated for us, that gave our issues, women's issues, a voice. And that leads me to the second context, the context of trade unionization at this moment. In the last 10 years, trade unionism has gone from 35% of all workers to 30%. That's less than one in three workers are covered by a trade, are represented by a trade union right now. Public sector union density in Canada is four times that of the private sector. That is, 72% of Canadians that are in that work in the private in the public sector are represented by a union. Only 17% of private sector workers are, and women dominate the public sector. Now, the public sector may not see very many cutbacks immediately, and if the recession is of short duration, they may not occur at all, because governments are aware across this country of the need to do something about poverty, and everybody understands the need to not compound this recession by cutting. So it's all about stimulus, and in some jurisdictions, it's even about poverty reduction. So most of the loss is going to be in the private sector. Unionized private sector jobs taking the biggest hit. But the next order of business will be retail, restaurant, and other largely non-unionized jobs, like many of your brothers and sisters in the community sector and in healthcare. So that leaves the public sector unions in a unique position and can be viewed by the public at large as offside or an elite group, not representing broader working people's concerns. And we need to guard against the unions being viewed, particularly public sector unions, being viewed as if they can't feel our pain type of emotions, where the working class is pitted against the working class. And it will be hard to get the public on side. It will be difficult on the wage front to bargain for example, COLA, with so many cost of living adjustments, with so many layoffs. Even harder to bargain for greater than inflation increases to close historic discrepancies. Pay equity, for example, the York sessional instructors. Those issues are going to be extremely difficult to fight for in this context. In fact, inflation may be deflation in the during your bargaining period. But the tension is this. Is zero increase enough politically for union members? Particularly since job cuts were never on the menu or are not on the menu in the immediate. Those outside the union movement will not look favorably on any increase if all they are experiencing is income loss because of job loss and because of loss of hours. So over the longer term, you have to consider is time, I mean, I was struck by the Quebec Union's focus in that thing that Anik was pointing out, is all about time, and perhaps bargaining will now start shifting from money to time. And this was, of course, the resolution, part of the suggestion on how to address rising joblessness in the early 1990s, the redistribution of work. And certainly some of these leaves that are being documented would be hugely helpful right now, but they may present a problem for people that are working more and earning less. In terms of benefits, we're going to see a massive wave of corporate consolidation to come in the wake of this period of downturn. Mergers and acquisitions are going to replace and dump benefit plans in the private sector, particularly pensions. And with these employment relations broken, historic deals will be overwritten. The new normal is going to bleed over from auto, where the legacy costs are killing us. And private sector and business approaches to human resources will continue to infect public sector practice. So pensions will become the new whipping boy. They're more discreet, less overt, and more potent than attacking wages directly. And if you say, well, that's not fair, the context is the value of pensions in the private sector savings have evaporated up to 50% in the last 3 months. So this is not a public campaign to try and hang on to what you've got, which let me be clear, what I'm not suggesting is that you roll over. There are gains to be had and ground to be kept at this moment. But I need you to consider, my job is for you to consider the context in which you hang on to what you have and that you agitate for gains. And my job here is to urge you to consider where your real strength is, not just in trade unionism, but the third context, the power of feminism. Trade union history shows us that no other working class group has been as powerful as trade unions. But at this moment, any individual trade union is not as powerful as collective groups. Who is in the trade union movement? Well, historically, their strength came from industrial unions, which were male-dominated. At this moment, the trade union movement is dominated by public sector workers, and that means it's dominated by women. QP. Where have women lain historically in fighting for change and fighting for equity? Well, our story is not about fighting for just me, but fighting for we. Our story is not about fighting for just us, but for fighting for justice, for fairness, for respect. Our roots are our roots are in the suffragettes demanding equal voice and the franchise in the vote, in the democratic process. Our roots are in growing girl power in the 1970s through both employment and through entering the trade union movement. But our roots are also cultural. Zero tolerance for gender inequality is where most of us started and cut our tooth. And now it's inequality itself that we must stand up and fight against. Not just women's inequality, but the injustices faced day by day by recent immigrants, by people of color, by Aboriginals, by the disabled community, by the gay, lesbian, and transsexual community. It is inequality throughout the system that we women must organize and fight against. And it is a working class fight. This is starting to look like class war. Obama last week talked about a pay cap of $500,000. That includes salaries and bonuses for the richest people on Wall Street. Well, boy, that's the first time in my life I've heard of anybody putting a cap on the top. But let me tell you, those handful of people that he's talking about, it's a great signal, it's a great message, but who is going to fight to raise up the bottom? That's our job. We are here to fight for those in the bottom half of the distribution who have been left behind in years of prosperity, as well as in recessionary years. We are here, and our we is broader than just the trade unions. The power is increasingly through consolidation and through coalition, and that is just as true of corporate power as it is for the rest of us. The growing consolidation of corporate power will demand a growing countervailing power of people. Whether it is through the democratic process or the extra-parliamentary system, we need to consolidate our power. And I ask you to consider, what is it that gives us our power? Our power is derived from organizing across sectors, regions that are fighting for the same thing. When we fought for UI in the 1930s, it took 13 years for that to happen, and it was a constitutional amendment in 1941. It took forever, but it took us across the country, irrespective of whether you were in a union or not in a union, or trying to organize yourself around associations. The pay equity fight took over a decade to see legislation, and it took an organized, focused fight. Our coalitions are the most powerful when we are fighting for the same thing across sectors, across neighborhoods, across regions. I would like to just point out that one of our most successful fights in recent memory is the $10 minimum wage fight in Ontario, where in a matter of months, coalitions actually worked together with the newspapers and pushed for something discreet, simple, understandable. The unfairness of wages at less than $10 an hour when you can be poor and still work full-time, full year was resonant with people across the province, and it took the union's leadership to lead that charge. So we know how to focus towards the goals that we want when we have specific pointed goals. Coalitions are most powerful when they're not fighting for bread and butter union issues for any particular union group or occupational group. Coalitions are most powerful when they're fighting for bread and butter issues for us all. So what can QP fight for with broad public backing? Anything to do with the wage floor. Reforming employment insurance, the Orwellianly labeled employment insurance, bring it back to the principles of unemployment insurance. Raise the minimum wage to 60% of the average wage. The living wage campaigns that are springing up across the country, which include QP members, particularly in home care, mental health care, etc. I refer for a moment to what Sidolia and Helen were talking about your top 10 list of what you should be doing. Poverty reduction strategies that are popping up in Quebec, Newfoundland, Ontario, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Manitoba, and potentially BC is one way of you organizing your fight. So poverty reduction becomes the theme, as pay equity was the theme, and there are numerous ways of achieving that goal within it. You are fighting for policies that do not undermine workers' bargaining power, like out-of-date employment standards that are not enforced, immigration policies that put a premium on temporary foreign worker permits, and the loss of pay equity. We are fighting for social wages too, not just for money. We're fighting for poverty prevention measures that incorporate most of your workers. And we are talking about fighting the prevention of the impacts of poverty, universal access to high-quality public services like health, education, community services, public transit, on and on. This is not just bread and butter issues for your members. It is the manifestation of prosperity for everyone. The most radical thing and the most meaningful thing you can do at this moment is to push to demarketize key components of household spending, because the market has told us where we can live and what we can afford in terms of our housing. It has told us what kind of early child education and development is accessible for whom. It has told us who can get access to meaningful lifelong learning, whether it's post-secondary education or training or skills upgrading. We can fight for these things because we cannot just purchase them on the market. And God knows we have to fight to demarketize community recreation and activities at a time like this. These are the sectors that keep our communities resilient, engaged, reduce isolation, maintain those things that keep people healthy. And so we also should be agitating for demarketized, subsidized access to preventive health care measures, including mental health. As I said, this is not bread and butter issues for the trade union, but they are bread and butter issues. And they put the social back into social unionism. This is a once in a lifetime opportunity. You know, we have fought for these things for 20 years or more, and the economy has grown and grown. The economy is four times bigger today than it was in 1981. And yet we're still fighting for those things. This moment of crisis is the crack in the wall. This is the opportunity to galvanize us, to help our generation rise to the challenge that has not been seen in generations. In fact, you will have heard that in this era of great repudiation of the Washington Consensus, where governments are the problem and markets are the solution, some people have said we're all Keynesians now, and what that means is that governments have an active role to play during a downturn. But in fact, in last week's cover of Newsweek magazine, there was a red hand shaking a blue hand on the cover, and the title was, "We're All Socialists Now." Well, damn right. And that is the context. And that's me, over and out.